for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Midway through an official tour of Asia, President Obama has had a full schedule in Shanghai and Beijing. The president has stressed the need for China to take up the burden of responsibility befitting the world's third largest economy. Some fear that in an effort to strike a friendly tone with China, the president is giving up an opportunity to push harder for improvements on human rights and the environment. Joining me to assess the president's trip and talk about the state of U.S.-China relations, Victor Cha. He's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and John Pomfret of The Washington Post, joining us from a studio at KSPC in Claremont, California, Min-Chin Pei of Claremont McKenna College. Of course, we welcome your calls. I'm so glad to be back with you and grateful to all those who sat in for me while I was gone. We'll welcome your calls on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And first, joining us is Ian Johnson. He's a correspondent for The Wall Street Journal based in Beijing. Good morning to you, Ian. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Ian, I know you're part of the press corps traveling with President Obama in Asia. Talk about his meeting with Hu Jintao. How did that go?
Sorry, could you say that again? I couldn't hear you.
You know, we may have too much trouble with this line. I'm afraid we'll have to try it once more. If it doesn't work, we'll have to let it go. How did the meeting between President Obama and Hu Jintao go?
Oh, well, the meeting, okay on one level. They had a series of agreements that they reached, and were significant. They were to agree that they wanted to push for climate change and for efforts to stabilize the economy. On the other hand, we got the impression that the two didn't get along too well together. I think there's a fundamental difference maybe in the two systems between China and the U.S., and see it in their body language at the press conference, that they just weren't really comfortable with each other.
So just watching them, you had the feeling that there was a discomfort between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. You had President Hu, and when President Obama was talking about human rights and the rights of different minority groups in China, President Hu was just standing poker face, not looking over. And when the Chinese president, Mr. Hu, was criticizing the U.S. for its budget deficits and its trade issues, President Obama was just sort of staring at the lecture and not looking over either. So you had two people who were almost own towers and not really communicating that well with them.
Tell me about President Obama's town hall style meeting in Shanghai and the censorship by the Chinese government. Did President Obama have anything to say about that afterwards?
No, he didn't talk about that. Personally, his aides did talk about that, and I think they said that there was some censorship, but overall, for people who wanted to get the message that could be received in China. Obviously, they wanted to put a good spin on it. China was not eager for the president to connect with Chinese people. I think they were a little worried about his charismatic personality and his way to connect with people. So they tried to limit his ability to talk with ordinary people.
But,
and I think that wasn't so expected, perhaps.
Well, but how, in your opinion, did he connect with the Chinese people?
I think for the people, there were about 600 or so people in the room. I think he did really well. I thought he gave good, concise answers. I think people were interested in what he had to say. The sad thing, a lot of what he said would not be seen by most people. It was not broadcast on television. It was streamed over the internet, but primarily on the White House website. So you'd have, if you were a Chinese person, you'd be going to the White House website. You know, most people wouldn't be able to understand English. They'd have to navigate through the website, and then that's difficult for most people. So probably Chinese person would not have seen that, unfortunately.
One last question, Ian. Tell us about this Obama-Mao controversy.
Oh, you say the Obama controversy?
Yes.
Okay, well, this guy in Beijing, and he had an idea for a funny t-shirt. He'd take President Obama's face, superimpose it over a picture of Chairman Mao, and underneath it was a slogan, "Serve the People," made some screened shirts, and it was in good fun, and it was funny. But I think the Chinese government thought that this would be disrespecting perhaps President Obama or Chairman Mao or who knows what, and they just basically banned the t-shirt, and you cannot get it in Beijing. You try to sell it, or you are in trouble. So they sort of clamped down on that. I think it wasn't necessary. I imagine that President Obama would really care about that. I think it's been in good fun.
Well, his opponents here in Washington might care about it a great deal. Ian Johnson, he's correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, based in Beijing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And turning to you now, John Pomfret, what are the big issues on President Obama's agenda for China?
With the Chinese, there are important security issues. So it's North Korea, the nuclear program in North Korea. We need China's help on that. The United States needs China's help in Iran. And also, we need China's help in two other really important areas, climate change and also the global financial mess. So pretty much four really important issues that they need to focus on.
And Victor Chai, in your opinion, has President Obama during this visit, considering the kind of body language that Ian was talking about, in your opinion, has he made any progress?
Well, it's really difficult to say, Diane. I think, it's the first visit. They're trying out a new China strategy. As John said, the four issues, climate change, economic recovery, Iran, North Korea, the big ones. On climate change, clearly it doesn't look like there was much progress at all. The Chinese have a lot of resistance, for reasons we can talk about, to some of the agenda for climate change. Or North Korea, it's difficult to tell because any progress with China on North Korea will not be seen by the public. Almost certainly President Obama talked to President Hu about pushing the North Koreans harder to return to the six-party talks to work on denuclearization. And that's something that the Chinese, if they do it, won't do it publicly. They'll do it without all of us seeing it. So it's difficult to say whether that has reached any progress. On Iran, the Chinese don't appear to be willing to do any more new sanctions. And on economic recovery, this is a long, involved topic, but basically the United States wants China to have stable and more predictable market-based macroeconomic and exchange rate policies. And China does not want to move in that direction.
But were there big expectations going forward, John.
No, the administration did its best to lower expectations for any type of deliverable.
I see.
In the beginning, we were all sort of scurrying around trying to find what the deliverable would be, and basically we were told there is going to be no deliverable. In fact, the deliverable is Obama goes to Asia. And what was claimed to be the U.S. re-engagement was specifically with Southeast Asia, which the Obama people believe has been ignored for 8 years under George Bush. So Obama was a deliverable, but in terms of anything concrete from China, we were basically instructed that not to expect anything.
But on the other hand, to what extent does China's role as the largest U.S. lender sort of give the U.S. some leverage, because China wants the U.S. to succeed. If it's holding all this money that the U.S. owes it, John?
Well, I mean, the Chinese actually are engaged in the United States economy in a way they've never been before. So, for example, they've had discussions with the administration about the administration's plans for healthcare reform. They want to ensure that the dollar is stable and doesn't tank, because that would mean that, of course, they would lose massively because their treasury bonds would tank. And so the Chinese really do care about the strength of the American economy in a way that they've never really cared before. Actually, they have, because we buy so much of their stuff. But there's an engagement in China on the Chinese side in the United States economy, and almost in some ways, not really a meddling, but a lecturing tone that you haven't heard from before from the Chinese.
John Pumphrey, he's diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and the Story of the New China. We'll take your calls and be right back. And welcome back. We're talking about President Obama's trip to Asia and, of course, his stop in Beijing, his conversations, if we can call them that, with President Hu Jintao. Here in the studio, John Pumphrey of The Washington Post, Victor Cha, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also professor of government at Georgetown University. Joining us now is Min-Chin Pei. He's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College in California. Good morning to you, Dr. Pei. Thanks
Good
for joining
to you,
us.
Diane.
Talk with us about the fact that you have said you thought President Obama's top issue with Hu Jintao would be Iran. Do you think he has made any progress there?
Not publicly. I think the time is right. In Singapore, President Putin, President Medvedev of Russia and President Obama reached an agreement on Iran. So China is now diplomatically alone. China used to hide behind Russia on the Iranian issue. Now China is all by itself. So all the spotlight is on China, and if President Obama wants to have any breakthrough with China on the Iranian issue, this would be the opportunity.
But President Obama has described the current situation, the unsatisfactory character of the Iranian response on the Tehran Research Reactor proposal. So where does that leave us? Is there pressure that can be exerted on the Chinese to take a more participatory role with Russia in acting out sanctions against Iran?
Well, as I said, there is an opportunity now. China used to be very lukewarm about sanctions, and they send the same tone as the Russians. Now, the situation has changed, unless the Russians, of course, are not sincere about what they've been saying to the Americans. But if the Russians were serious about the Iranian issue, then the U.S., the Russians, the Europeans can put a lot of diplomatic pressure on China. And the last thing China wants to do in the international community is to be isolated, is to be seen as an obstacle to a very serious security issue.
Is there any question, Dr. Pei, that the Russians may not be serious?
Well, that I really do not. I'm not a Russia expert. I think the Russians have been dancing around this issue for some time. Some time ago, they said one thing, which the Americans interpreted as encouraging, then they backed off. This time they said something else, which, again, Washington viewed quite positively. We really have to wait and see.
Victor Cha.
I think, yes, we can never be sure with regard to Russian intentions. But what's interesting about this Iran thing is there's a lot of pieces in motion now because, as Minchin said, you know, I think Obama worked hard on who to try to get some movement from Beijing on sanctions on Iran. At the same time, President Obama was in Tokyo, where you had the new Japanese prime minister that talked in his opening press statement about Japan's historic relationship with Tehran. And having participated in the manufacturing of these summit statements, you know, that was really something that has never come up before in U.S.-Japan official statements. So we don't know, are the Japanese under this new government looking at a different way of trying to deal with the Iran issue? They have a lot of investments in Iran that they have held conditional on Iranian cooperation on the nuclear issue. So there are a lot of pieces at play here.
John Pomfret.
Also with the Chinese, we have to understand that in a way, if you're looking at this cynically, if there are sanctions against Iran, the Russians don't lose out because the oil prices will spike. Russia is an oil exporter, and so there is not really a silver lining, but obviously the Russians could perhaps emerge from that problem, you know, with some type of benefits. But for the Chinese, a spike in oil prices is bad news. And secondly, the Chinese also have, in terms of memorandums of understanding, about $100 billion or so committed to the Iranian oil and gas industry. Secondly, Iran is China's number two oil provider. And so China has significant economic interests. And so, yes, Minxin is completely right. The Chinese don't want to be perceived to be the outlier. Hmm. That said, they have very, very significant economic interest in Iran.
Turning from Iran to North Korea, what about any conversations, real conversations there, Victor?
Well, I think any real conversations would have taken place in as small a group as Obama could get President Hu in, which the Chinese generally don't like to do. I think he probably told him that the president is going to send his envoy to North Korea to meet with the North Koreans, as the Chinese had wanted. And then if that leads to some sort of progress back to six-party talks, that's great. But if it doesn't, I think, the United States will be pushing the Chinese to use a lot of its material leverage to twist the North Koreans' arms and bring them back to the six-party process.
Help me to understand what it is about the Chinese character that is reluctant to meet in small groups.
Well, the larger the group, the more formal the setting. And the formal setting allows the Chinese to get their talking points across. without having to engage in a genuine exchange. I think most American presidents, I know President Bush, always wanted to try to get Hu Jintao in as small a group as possible, even if that meant changing the seating chart at lunch so he could sit right next to President Hu and have a serious conversation with him where he could hear genuinely what President Hu thinks rather than what the official talking points are. And one would imagine that President Obama tried to do the same thing with President Hu, to have a real serious and genuine conversation about North Korea, because this is something where both Beijing and Washington have absolutely convergent interests. They're, both of them do not want to see North Korea walking around with nuclear weapons in the East Asian region.
So
something about
certainly,
a smaller group.
Of course, Jack.
Well, in Chinese politics, the president of China does not have a lot of power. It is so-called collective leadership. President Hu has to clear with his Politburo colleagues about the talk points. That's why he does not want to be spontaneous. He does not have the Politburo's backing behind his back. That's why it's very frustrating for American presidents who try to have one-on-one sessions with their so-called counterparts. Mm-hmm. It turns out that they don't have a real counterpart in Beijing. Their real counterpart is a 9-member Politburo Standing Committee.
Min Jin Pei is professor of government at Claremont McKenna College in California. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. John Pomfret, what about climate change? Did anyone in this country have true and real expectations about some measure of agreement on climate change?
Oh, with the Chinese?
With the Chinese.
In this case, no. I think that there's a lot of, obviously, similar interests. Everyone wants to improve the environment, such as it is. But once you get into the details, there's real problems. The Chinese want us to give them massive amounts of money. They also want us to give them the technology to use to improve their environment. And U.S. companies, some are quite willing to do that, but others are quite reluctant because they worry that that technology will be stolen by Chinese companies and then exported around the world, and they'll become basically a competitor in clean tech as well. So I think that there's a lot of mutual interest on this, but the devil's in the details, and they're having significant difficulty actually working things out. And then the other issue is, for example, if you get down to like one technology, for example, carbon sequestration, there's a talk about some type of a pilot project. Well, where should it be? Should it be in China or in America? Well, the U.S. Congress doesn't really want to pay for a large carbon sequestration plant in China, so let's put it in America. But in America, you had some Chinese backers of that project who have since pulled out. So getting these things done, actually, and actually working on the ground is another issue. And the other issue with carbon sequestration is, why have the government pay for a technological sort of experimentation when you already have private industry doing that? So there's a lot of talk, in some ways happy talk, about working together on the environment, but the reality is going to be quite difficult.
Victor.
Yeah, I mean, John's got it exactly right. I mean, the Chinese are very reluctant for cost reasons. They also use the development argument is that they should not bear the costs of climate change that the developed countries didn't have to pay for. The other area, of course, is nuclear energy, where the Chinese now have only less than 1% of their total energy production is nuclear. And I think there's a lot of interest in growing there. The problem is that they can build these nuclear plants without the level of regulation, domestic and international regulation, that we see in the West, which could, of course, be very dangerous. So I think for all these reasons, there hasn't been a lot of progress on climate change. You know, Rasmussen came from Denmark to APEC to basically let everybody know that no one was looking for a major agreement, either at APEC or at Copenhagen, this time. So I think everybody has taken a more realistic view of this now, but unfortunately it means there are no real deliverables on climate change.
Now, we've spoken about climate change, we've spoken about North Korea, Iran. You know, I find myself wondering, as I hear all of you talking, was this trip realistic? Was it necessary? What is it accomplishing? Dr. Pei.
Well, it is accomplishing at least one objective. That is, Obama has been to China. he has shown to the Chinese leadership and the Chinese people that Washington is very serious about this bilateral relationship. There is a lot on the plate, and China will have to cooperate with the U.S. The ball is now in China's hand. Obama has committed his political capital, and he comes back. He will face criticisms about not accomplishing anything in concrete. And then I think the administration will have to go back to the Chinese and say, we have to tango. It takes two to tango.
I think these visits, you know, usually you use the presidential visit to the region as an action-forcing event to push a lot of deliverables through the bureaucracies of both governments. And, you know, unfortunately, that didn't happen on this trip. I think there is a lot to be said for the president of the United States, especially the first president who's actually lived in Asia, American president lived in Asia, to actually go to Asia. I mean, I think that's huge, hugely important. But in the end, that lasts for about 2 weeks, and then people are looking for what were the agreements that were reached. You know, APEC was the biggest, it's the biggest multilateral trade meeting in Asia. APEC countries make up 50% of global trade. And, you know, the United States went to APEC without an enunciated trade policy. And many countries in Asia and the world are wondering where the United States stands on trade.
It's 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. John Pomfret.
Victor made a really important point about trade, which is probably the sort of the Achilles heel of the United States policy in Asia right now. We have a free trade agreement with South Korea that has languished for 2 years. It hasn't been ratified by the Senate. Meanwhile, South Korea's inked trade agreements with the European Union and with India. We have ASEAN and the Chinese on January 1st of next year will be carrying out a free trade agreement amongst themselves. We have South Korea, Japan, and China talking about a free trade agreement amongst themselves. And so we face the United States possibly being sort of cut out of these free trade agreements. Now, obviously, United States labor unions have an important say in this, and they have a lot of interest because they feel that if we conclude free trade agreements with countries, we will lose lots of American jobs. And so, obviously, the Obama administration has to be cognizant of those issues. At the same time, the United States, with a series of trade agreements being inked between countries in Asia, really does face the possibility of being shut out in terms of trade in Asia, which would not be necessarily good for the U.S. economy or for its influence. If you sort of follow the idea that the business of Asia is business, and it is, and if we're less of a player there, we have a lot less influence.
And what about the currency issue? That's been very difficult. What's occurred on that front, Victor?
Well, there hasn't been much progress. You know, the Chinese basically have pegged their currency to be slightly cheaper than the U.S. dollar, which undercuts competitiveness of American goods. The problem that we run into is, of course, every time they're concerned that the dollar is weakening in value, they buy more U.S. treasuries to try to prop up the dollar. You know, this becomes sort of a mutual hostage situation where they need us as much as we need them. So I think on the one hand, people talk about the China economic threat, quote unquote. On the other hand, you know, if China were to dump all of these treasuries that they hold tomorrow, you know, our credit card rates, our mortgage rates would go skyrocketing. We'd have a huge recession. We wouldn't be able to buy any more goods, and that would hurt China's exports to the United States. So we're very much intertwined. Mm-hmm. In a way that two countries, established power and a rising power, have never been intertwined like this in the history of international relations.
But what about the question of China manipulating its own currency?
Yeah, I mean, this is clearly an issue, and that's why a top-line agenda item for the Obama administration is to try to get China to have more of have free market forces really determine their exchange rate. It's basically set by the bank, the Central Bank of China, and everybody's legally bound to it. And that is, you know, that is artificial manipulation of the currency, because if they were allowed it to float, the value of the Chinese currency would probably be much higher than it is now.
Well, but China's central bank regulator is saying that the U.S. currency issues are really the U.S.'s fault because our interest rates are too low, John.
Well, I mean, the best defense is a good offense. And so the Chinese will invariably always criticize the United States' fiscal policies, and they definitely have some say and some point to that. But I think it's more tactic than anything else. That said, with the whole question of currency manipulation. During the campaign, Obama accused China of manipulating its currency. But since he's entered office, the Treasury Department has had two occasions to say whether China was a currency manipulator or not, and has, on both occasions, declined to state it as a currency manipulator. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner did, in his testimony to Congress before he was approved, did name China as a currency manipulator, but since then he's backed off, which is a sign that the Obama administration is really bending over backwards to improve its ties with China.
Victor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that John's right. The tone has changed. And in part, I think, because the administration has taken an approach with China that is very conciliatory in tone and really says we're not trying to contain China, and China is at the center of our global agenda. Now, there's some people who say that's the right way to approach China. There's others who would say that's not the way you deal with China. If you think they're a currency manipulator, you tell them that.
Victor Cha, he's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. Your calls are most welcome.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Academy Award-winning actress Cate Blanchett on her starring role on stage in A Streetcar Named Desire, her film career, and her work to raise awareness about climate change. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. We'll open the phones now for your calls, your contributions to our conversation on the president's visit to China. First to Glendale, Maryland. Good morning, Erasmus. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Diane. Thank you so much, sir, for taking my call.
Certainly.
Yeah, I'm really happy because for over 10 years, I've always tried to reach you, but never. Well, my contribution is about the importance of President Obama's working visit to China. If we look around, we would see that the reason Pyongyang, Tehran, and you name it, all the countries that have been proven very stubborn, even to the United Nations, why they do this is simply because they kind of feel that China and Russia have never been on the same side with the United States of America. So that if this time around we succeed, if Obama succeeds in winning China over, Russia does not matter so much because China, I feel, is more relevant
All right, Erasmus, thanks for your call. The question is, can the U.S. win over China? It sure doesn't look that way right now, John.
I think the Chinese are feeling their oats.
Yeah.
And I think that they feel that they can say no to the United States a lot more easily than they could, let's say, 5 or 10 years ago. And they also have a very clear, a much clearer idea of what their interests are. For example, on the North Korea question, obviously on the surface, both countries don't want to see nuclear weapons in Pyongyang. But I would contend that China's number one goal in North Korea really is not getting rid of the nukes. It's ensuring that the North Korean regime remains stable. And that does change the way that China would interact. As far as the U.S. administration concerned, they really don't care whether the Kim Jong-il administration stays around. But for the Chinese, it's quite important because they do not want to see a collapse in North Korea. That would mean 250,000 refugees in their territory. That would mean perhaps having to deal with the U.S. military forces moving up to secure the nuclear sites. I mean, this is opens a whole Pandora's box for China. And so that's just one example of where they were going to be more reluctant to cooperate.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, the other thing I would add is, more broadly, how do you win over China? You know, this administration has taken a very different tact at the start than previous administrations. Previous administrations, you know, the Clinton administration came in and said, we're not coddling dictators, right? And conditioned human rights on most favored nation status. The Bush administration came in, had very strong language, pro-Taiwan. You had the EP3 incident where a Chinese plane got shot down. And in both cases, they started out very tough, and then they moved in the direction of a more pragmatic, cooperative policy. The Obama administration has come in, and it's been very open-armed, you know, conciliatory. China's at the center of our global agenda. And as he said in his speech in Japan, very clearly, the U.S. does not seek to contain China. They've set very high expectations for what China should do on the global agenda. And my concern is they're going to be terribly, terribly disappointed because China is not yet ready to play on the global stage, whether it's contributing to the collective good of climate change or being very responsible on Iran, or working hard on economic recovery. They have a developing country mentality. They're not ready to play this role. So I think the administration is going to be quite disappointed.
Dr. Pei, would you agree with that?
Well, I agree to some extent. The administration indeed is setting the bar too high. But for the Chinese, it's a matter of price. If you want us to do XYZ, can you offer us ABC? And what's missing in this dialogue is that what the U.S. has that China would like to have.
Such as?
And China has its... one thing China would really like to have is the so-called market economy status. China is viewed by U.S. law as a non-market-based economy, and that makes China very vulnerable to American trade sanctions. And China has been urging the U.S. to give itself, to give China this status. And the U.S., of course, has said no. So this is something that the administration should definitely leverage when it deals with China.
Explain that, John.
Well, that has to do with how the price of China is. When the United States moves to do countervailing tariff cases against Chinese goods, for example, they don't actually use what the price of that good is in the Chinese market as the metric by which they just sort of determine whether that good is being sold at too low a price in the United States. They use actually a basket of other countries as the metric. And so they don't look at the Chinese market because they don't consider the Chinese market a free market. And giving the Chinese market a free market status would actually change that and actually strengthen, in many cases, China's cases in the United States in terms of countervailing tariffs or dumping cases. And that's an important economic issue for the Chinese.
All right. Yeah. Caller in Clinton, New York. Good morning, Susan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane, and I'm very interested in all the panelists and the topic. I am an instructor at Utica College, and in the spring I will be teaching a course on civil society and the Internet in China, and so I've been avidly reading Professor Pei's book on China's trapped transition. My question is for Professor Pei, and it has to do, I just was reading your chapter this weekend on democratizing China. I was very interested in President Obama's statements about the Internet, but of course all of his discussions relate to the United States. Rhetorically, I think most Chinese and the Chinese government would understand that as a comparison with the situation in China. My question for Professor Pei is, do you think that the internet can create a more, either a civil society in China or more democratizing civil society as it is changing? Or do you think it's really limited, the internet's effect can really only be limited to democratizing communications?
Well, I think the internet is really transforming China in a very unexpected way. It is not creating a civil society on the ground in China. The Communist Party will never allow that. But it is creating a so-called virtual civil society. And this civil society is not necessarily pro-democracy. Part of it is very nationalistic. Part of it is very liberal. And part of it is for social justice. So the impact on the Chinese government has been quite significant. And the Chinese government today has to respond to issues raised on the internet. I'll give you just one example. In the summer, a girl who was a waitress in a hotel was attacked by a local official who tried to rape her, and she defended herself and used a knife to kill the local official. And the local government initially tried to charge her with murder. And then there was such an outcry on the internet that eventually the girl was let off free, as in the case of self-defense. So that kind of instance shows that the internet is indeed a big political factor in China.
At the same time, here is an email from Tony, who says it's pointless to clamor for any sitting U.S. president to push the human rights issue in talks with the Chinese. They have their own agenda for social evolution, and we have no leverage with which to push that evolution in any direction or to speed up the process. Do you agree with that, John?
Well, traditionally before summits, the Chinese would almost always release one or two prominent dissidents as a sign of friendship, or at least the fact that they were listening to the Americans. This is a summit where that did not happen. And human rights organizations have argued that the sort of lowballing or the soft peddling of the human rights issue that the Obama administration is undertaking with the Chinese has actually hurt the Chinese, the dissident issue in China. So a lot of it has to do with the strategy that the Obama administration is embracing. And as Obama officials have said, they're trying to lead by example. So they're trying to clean up the United States human rights record and show the Chinese that we can be better and be a model for the Chinese. That's something that human rights people they don't really buy that line.
Victor.
Well, I think Tony has an important point, but that also means that we don't just give up. I mean, I think as John said, the United States has traditionally made quite a big deal. It's been a big part of the U.S.-China agenda, the human rights aspect of it, and that has forced China at times to do these things in advance of visits or in advance of big meetings where they will make symbolic gestures to release some dissidents. The idea that we could somehow lead by example and softly push the human rights issue, I really don't know if that works, quite frankly. You know, when President Obama decided last month not to meet with the Dalai Lama, I'm sure that was meant as a sign that the United States is trying to work with China
and
quietly.
And respect to China.
But I think the message it sends to the Chinese is that they've got us. They basically got us because, you know, the Dalai Lama received the Congressional Medal of Honor. Although Senator Obama had met with the Dalai Lama, I think it was a pretty big statement about where the administration put the human rights issue on the overall agenda with China.
All right, to Washington, D.C., and our caller, Gerald. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I think the administration's moving in the right direction, and they're dealing with China. And here's why I think that. Considering the reemergence of China back onto the world stage and the respect that the president is trying to show, the humiliation of China in the 19th century and the World War and in the 20th century, occupation by Japan, all of these things being taken into the collective historical mindset of the administration and saying, how are we going to deal with them? We don't need to go. And another thing, you don't go to a guest house and embarrass them by pressing too hard for certain things. You do that quietly, and I really think hopefully that's what the administration is doing. But I think taking these things into historical context, you don't want to humiliate China. You don't want to pressure them to do things because they're just coming out of this pressure. And I think the way to deal with them is the way the administration is dealing with them, being somewhat conciliatory, but also but dealing from a position of strength, too.
All right, sir. Victor Chung.
Well, I mean, the caller is right. I mean, President Obama, you know, he did, the only place he did some sightseeing was in China, showing great respect for the civilization and the history there. And I think that is important. And sure, these meetings are part of a get to know President Obama. That's certainly one aspect of it. But, you know, in the end, you know, in policymaking, you've got to push issues. You have to push issues. And summits are really the sort of the pinnacle of where you really try to move difficult issues forward that you can't move forward at a lower level. So in that sense, I think while it's good to show respect, an opportunity was also missed.
I guess I'm still wondering about the strategy here, John Pomfret. I think of the Obama administration, surely within the campaign, as planning each step, sort of anticipating what will come next. It sounds as though what they're getting from China is a resounding no on all issues.
I think that, as Victor said, the expectations that the administration has had for China have been very, very high. I mean, they didn't generate it, but there's this idea that the United States and China are going to form a G2 that's going to solve all the problems of the world. And I think that, as Victor said, the Chinese really are a developing country, and they're not ready in many cases to embrace these ideas. But the administration somehow believes that with China at our side, we're going to march forward and solve all the problems of the world. And the Chinese are a little reluctant to do that. I mean, they're looking out very, very, one, their interests are quite mercantile, and two, their interests are very focused on getting their people more food, you know, a better lifestyle, big screen TVs or whatever, and that's a little bit different than our interests, which
and
are more global.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. It's a great program.
Thank you.
And there are so many things to comment on, so I'll kind of limit it here. But
sure.
One thing I haven't really heard is any discussion of China is a very inward-looking country. They really haven't concentrated on an outward influence, even though we seem to think that a lot of these deals for oil and such are. But their vital concern with us on the international agreements and such is really Taiwan. And I don't think Americans understand China would actually go to war over Taiwan without a doubt. So they'll use Taiwan when they negotiate with us about North Korea, when there's certain things going on with Japan, whether we get a base. Japan has opened up to China more than they have in more than 60 years right now. So, you know, Americans tend to look at these things only from the American standpoint and understand China's a very different culture and is out only for themselves. They're not yet as concerned. They want to rule. They want to govern or be the power in Asia eventually, but it's a slower process than what our media actually tends to show us.
Rick, thanks for your call. John Pomfret.
I think Rick made a very good point about the Taiwan issue. It's very important, and it's basically, as the Chinese said in their joint statement with the United States released today, that it's a core issue. The interesting thing is that the United States, in its joint statement, seem to give the Chinese a bit of a compromise, or at least a present, and it didn't mention, the United States basically says it follows the One China policy and abides by the principles of the three U.S.-China joint communiques. That's what the Americans said in the joint statement. And the joint statement doesn't mention the Taiwan Relations Act, which is an act by Congress which obliges the United States to, in a somewhat ambiguous way, come to Taiwan's defense. And this is not mentioned in our joint statement with the Chinese, which I think is another example of how the United States is being conciliatory and soft-pedaling this critical issue with the Chinese. Because the Taiwan Relations Act is also what the United States uses to justify significant arms sales to the Taiwanese military, something that always gets up the Chinese nose.
Finally, Dr. Pei, what do you believe President Obama has accomplished with his visit?
Well, he has accomplished, as I said, a very important objective, that is to show to the Asians that the U.S. is very interested in remaining a Pacific power. For the last few years, the U.S. has been too focused on the war on terrorism, Iraq and Afghanistan. And as a result, American interests were neglected. And now Mr. Obama wants to correct that problem.
And that
to some extent, he has succeeded, even though there's not much concrete deliverables for him to deliver.
Minxin Pei, he's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College in California. John Pomfret at The Washington Post. Victor Cha, he's associate professor of government at Georgetown University. Thank you all very, very much for being here.
Thank you,
Diane. Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.